If you enjoy this podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all future episodes. Also, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/switchboxtv for video versions of this show, plus loads more videos covering sport, music, and lifestyle. That's youtube.com/switchboxtv. This episode was recorded in July 2020. Welcome to the Need to Know Music Show here on Switchbox TV. I'm Ryan McManus, and today I'm joined by Hunter and the Bear, a rock band who released their debut album in 2017, and since then have gone strength to strength. And this year, their single Digital Light hit number one in the iTunes rock chart. And I'm joined by all the guys today. How you getting on?
Yeah, good.
We are good.
We're going to have slots or something, aren't we? Have some sort of signal that you're about to talk.
Raise your hand.
So do you want each of you sort of introduce yourselves then, just in a proper sort of team building exercise way?
None of us have ever done team building exercises, but
me neither. But this is what I've heard.
My name is Will, and I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a singer, and I am enjoying lockdown to the best of my ability.
I'm John, I'm the lead guitarist, and I'm also trying to make the most of lockdown.
I am Gareth, I play the drums, and I too am making the most of lockdown.
My name's Chris, I'm the bass player, and I'm also making the most out of lockdown.
Everyone knows the order goes drummer last. What happened there? You skipped the queue.
They save the best till last normally, don't they?
So you've been making the most of lockdown, I hear. So have you done any sort of live streams and stuff, or what's been going on? You've all been in different parts of the UK, I take it from what you've been saying.
Yeah, I kind of said that ironically, because it's been pretty rubbish lockdown for, you know, obviously everyone. But for us, we've been apart the whole time, just because we live in slightly different areas. So this is like how we've been being a band, you know, sort of locking on Zoom and going, yeah, has anyone had any cool ideas recently? Or, you know, it's very different to the normal rehearsal room scenario. But yeah, we've managed to somehow do all sorts of like live stream stuff. We've done put together some cover videos, and we're getting together in the next couple of weeks, so all will be resumed to normality.
Excellent. I mean, it's just that annoying thing of not being able to play. There's too much of a delay, isn't there, by doing stuff remotely live. It just can't be done.
We did try it, and it was absolute carnage. Like we were on a Zoom call, and I think Will had an acoustic guitar, and we all just tried to play, and it was so bad.
If you've sung Happy Birthday to anyone on Zoom, then you'll know how difficult it is to stay in time. And if you add instruments into the mix, it's just a complete write-off.
It's kind of like one of those things where you sing it around, isn't it? Like, burning or something. And everyone's slightly aligned behind the next person.
Yeah.
But I think that has to be the next, I mean, this has to be the next technological advance, I think. It has to be making is that remote playing in time. There must be some way of doing it. I think all of us have been racking our brains and our, and you know, musicians aren't really known for our sort of technical know-how, but so I think it's been frustrating across the board from what I've heard, you know. But do you guys tend to write together? Is that kind of how it works, or does one of you come up with? Is one of them carrying most of the songwriting burden?
I do a lot of it, but that's been mainly just down to sort of, you know, the time that we've had and things. I think anyone can bring in an idea, and you know, a lot of the time someone will have like a song, and then it'll get sort of, you know, finished off with the group, and I think that's a pretty good way to do it, because like starting, you know, co-writing is fine, but starting from scratch with just like four guys in a room can be just chaos. And I think I quite like sort of, and I'm, you know, we've all done it in the past, is sort of get something that's like your vision yourself, and you know, you're kind of happy with, and then bring it to the rehearsal room, and then it becomes like a band song. That's kind of how we run things, and that, I guess that's good, because, and we're all kind of like, we've made sure that over this period we've all got good on like our recording and Logic and Pro Tools and stuff, so we can sort of send each other things, which makes it a lot easier to actually function.
To come in with a like fleshed out idea, and then, you know, for example, like Gareth's a much better drummer than I am, so like, you know,
don't put yourself down.
We'd come up with like a loose framework for a drum part, but then it's up to like our own little stations to really like hone it in to what it should be.
Yeah, I mean, that's I found that in the, I mean, I'm a musician myself, and I found that in the past, it always kind of like comes out the other end sounding like the band anyway, because everyone brings their own thing to the party. It seems to be the best way to do it. But
I think,
so just thinking about where you go on.
I think one of the other things as well is that, like, after a while, a band sort of figures out what they want to sound like. And that's the one biggest tool for writing, is that we all completely understand what we want our end goal to be in terms of the actual, like, the finished product. So even going in and doing the second album, it sounded so how we wanted it to be, just because, you know, we were all kind of like, you know, pushing towards that goal. And so even if you're at the beginning of a writing project or a song, or you're right at the very end, you've got that vision in your head. So when you're writing for a specific band, it's you know, it's quite easy like that.
So you're all kind of tuned into each other's playing, and your shared vision is really together. And that's great. It must cut down on time and that kind of thing. You know, it must be
and
really
just knowing what we all like.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So you guys just talk about where you all sort of started getting into music and stuff from the start. So we'll have to go one by one. Now I'll start with I'm actually going to start with Chris.
Nice. Hey, yeah.
So because he hasn't said that much so far, because no one really asked the bass player anything.
That's 100% true. And I normally say something stupid and embarrassing. Is the question how I sort of got into music originally, or?
Yeah, I mean, basically your musical upbringing and kind of what sort of age you were when you first sort of got into playing music.
I was actually like super lucky. I came from quite a musical household. So I played bass guitar because my dad was a drummer and my brother was a guitarist. And we lived with my grandmother, who was a pianist. So I just played bass because I wanted to jam. And then my dad had like a jam band that would come around every Thursday, and I'd bring down like a box of beer at like 7:30 in exchange for jamming a tune or two. But that was when I was about 10. So then then sort of became addicted to bass really, and then spent most of my teenage years on tour in really, really heavy death metal bands, and then realized that if you want to progress past playing to eight people, you need to diversify, which is a good thing because I've got quite a wide taste of music. But I'm in a very happy position now, playing with a bunch of like-minded people who are in it to win it really. So
fantastic. And Gareth?
Yeah. So for me, it was kind of a similar story. I didn't have a very musical household, but just picked up the drums in school and just loved it. Joined every single musical project I could. Started playing in like jazz bands and big bands and orchestras. And the whole thing was I just absolutely loved it. I started off in the rock world, started listening to like Keith Moon and Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And then I was just like a bit of a, I'll just take whatever I can get. And just kind of sort of ran with that really, got really into sort of, like I said, jazz and blues. My first gig was in a blues band in a bar to about four people. And there were about 10 saxophonists in the band. One guitarist, one drummer and 10 saxophonists. It was the worst band ever. and then from there I've progressed to Hunter and the Bear.
So you spent your time trying to drown them out, basically.
Yeah. You have to be pretty hard if you've got loads of saxophones in your band.
How about John?
So I didn't have like a really musical family either. But guitar was kind of, I was always obsessed with Jimi Hendrix as a kid, and started playing guitar and kind of following in those footsteps and like practicing loads. But I kind of got swallowed up a bit by the classical music world. I started playing like brass instruments and playing in orchestras and big bands when I was quite young, and then ended up going to music college and getting a classical music degree, which so far has been completely useless because now I'm in a rock band. but yeah, that's been it. So yeah.
The good is you're taking solos to go, "This is Mozart, you heathens," as you're just wailing this solo. It'd be brilliant.
Yeah, pretty much. My old professor's like shaking their fists at me, you know, playing the guitar.
And Will, you're from the Highlands of Scotland, is that right? That's correct, is that right?
Yeah, I am indeed. It's a very musical place, but it's all quite different to what we do. It's, you know, traditional music there is everyone plays. So in my primary school, you had to either play the pipes, the fiddle, or the accordion. It was like, you know, everyone played something. I played the fiddle very badly, and I was about 6 years old, and the day my dad decided that music wasn't for me was when he came into my room where I was being taught the fiddle, and I was lying on my back on my bed playing the fiddle like over the edge of the bed, like, you know, no chords, just like and the poor woman was stood over me just sort of like shaking her head, being like, "This guy, he just doesn't care about music." And so at that point it was decided by me and everyone else that I wasn't in any way musical, and then spent my whole school life not really doing anything to do with music. I loved music, but I never played it. And then when I got to university, I started playing guitar just because someone had one that was in my halls. And I just became obsessed. And I think it was just like, it was at the wrong time when I was 6 years old. And then when it came to me when I was sort of 17, 18, it was like, I was just hooked immediately. And then very soon after that, Hunter and the Bear was formed. And
so you never really sang as a youngster?
No, I mean, the first thing I ever did was in my last year of school, like the drama, I did drama A level, and the teacher asked me to audition for the school musical, and I was like, you know, I was into drama and stuff, but I definitely couldn't sing in my head. I was like, I can't sing, I don't want to do that, it's going to just be embarrassing, you know. And like in school, it's kind of like not cool to be the like out there singer person. So I was terrified, and you know, I was just like a normal sporty kid, but he sort of twisted my arm, luckily, and pushed me to audition. And it was We Will Rock You, the Queen musical, and I ended up doing one of the lead roles, and I loved it. And you know, I was rough around the edges for sure. I was just sort of like belting every single word, just like trying to get a bit of Freddie on the go. But yeah, that was my first experience of singing, and I thought it was. We took the show to the Edinburgh Fringe, which was really cool. And then, you know, got a chance to play in front of some audiences that weren't just sort of parents. And yeah, I guess from that point on, that was probably the start of it all. And then went straight to learning guitar at university. And then here we are.
Was it Newcastle University?
Northumbria. It was like the one for less intelligent people that is also.
But that's where it all kind of started for when you started. That's where Hunter and the Bear started. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could say that. I mean, it started in London, but I was playing gigs. My first gigs were in Newcastle, but that was without these guys. It was with a different guy who was originally in the band, and we then moved to London to do it. and found these guys. And yeah, and then John joined more recently when that original guy left the band, you know, a year or 18 months ago or something like that. And yeah, and so, but it only really felt like a band, obviously, when we had a band. So we started off as two guys and then three guys just playing acoustic instruments. But when we added these lovable hunks of meat, we became a band. And that was when
you haven't seen each other in a while, have you?
No. So, I feel like I don't know them very well. So, oh, hey guys, how's it going?
What were those early gigs like? What sort of venues were you playing? The sort of usual London original venues, or yeah. what you're doing?
Someone else take this question, because I've been.
We just kind of like in this classic form, moving to London, you just sort of take whatever you can get. There are all these kind of little residencies at places like the Troubadour and the Bedford, and upstairs at Ronnie Scott's is where a couple of us met as well. Like, they sort of offer these like almost kind of open mics, but they're a little bit more structured than that. And you know, the band gets about half an hour, 45 minutes to sort of set up their breakables and then just go, you know, and sort of do the best they can, really. So we did a bunch of that stuff as much as we could before contacting other people and starting to sort of support other bands that we knew that were on the same circuit, that was, you know, supposedly doing a little bit better and playing in different places too. And then the second or third year, we found ourselves, we managed to get enough money together to buy a van and started just driving everywhere. Like, we would go from sort of Devon to Manchester, back down to Bristol, and then back up to Scotland. And, you know, we were just like, the open road is ours. And ended up just going anywhere where people would have us. We played in cinemas, we played in like bowling alleys, in theatres, all kinds of things, like arts clubs all around the country, and started just trying to build things up as well as festivals.
Another thing, sorry to butt in, Gareth, but worth mentioning alongside that is at this point, like, we were seriously in need of like any sort of backing, and we had nothing between us. We're all working like crappy jobs alongside to sort of try and be able to pay for rehearsal room and things like that. And we ended up, we like searched for ages for the cheapest rehearsal space in town, because London can be like crazy expensive. If you just sort of Google rehearsal room, it's like, oh yeah, $2,000 a day. And we were just like, you know, we had nothing. So we found this guy who lived in a shipping container in a car park. And it was in like Shoreditch, was it?
Yeah, it was, that kind of like manor house kind of part of town, yeah, East London.
We found him, and he charged, I think it was $4.50 an hour, which was like mental rates compared to everywhere else. And so we used to have to go, we'd knock on the door of it, which would wake him up. He'd get out of his bed, and he would leave for the sort of 4 or 5 hours that we were going to play. And we'd just be in like his house, and which was the shipping container. And all it had was a little tiny sort of cocktail drum kit, and then like a couple of really overly loud amps. And we just get in there, and we used to leave the cash in the microwave for him when he finished. And then we just head off. It was class.
Try not to put the microwave on.
Instant house fire.
But yeah, that was where we honed our songs.
This sounds like the plot of some really strange movie. You've got to make this the story of a movie. That'd be brilliant.
Well, it's hard to believe these places still exist. It's hard to believe that people are still sort of doing that, because there's a very, like, you know, there's all kinds of music studios and like rehearsal studios and things like that. But it's, you know, and I imagine will just become increasingly tougher for bands to sort of generate anything, you know, especially in the middle of London when everyone's trying to sort of stay alive. So yeah, it makes for a good story, you know, and it really stank. That was the biggest problem.
You were like instantly high from the second you walked in because of the like amount of residual weed. It was just
Yeah, he had cannabis air fresheners. You know, like those ones that you hang in your car, but he was hanging them all on the ceiling of this little unit, and they were shaped like cannabis leaves, and the whole room stank of artificial cannabis.
It was great.
Like, the real smell.
Like, he wanted to be high so badly that even when he wasn't high, he wanted to smell like he was high.
Well, yeah. I mean, fake cannabis is a lot safer than actual cannabis, I suppose. So it's kind of a healthy option.
Yeah.
So how did you go from fake cannabis shipping container to releasing your first, or to before you release your first album? You actually went on tour with Eric Clapton, I was reading. So how did you go from shipping container, almost homeless guy, to Eric Clapton? How did that transition? How quickly did you transition from that place to that place?
Very quickly, shockingly quickly for us. I mean,
Eric Clapton was that guy in the shipping container. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Layla.
it was a shock. The Clapton thing was so early, and we got that off the back of like just a plot. We literally, like, our management sent an email being like, new UK rock band, like, here's a demo, we'd love to support you. And like nothing, we didn't even think about it. We thought it was just like dead in the water. It was just, we were laughing at the fact we'd even asked. And then we got this email that was like, oh, Eric and the team have listened to your stuff and would love you to support on the like arena tour. And we're like, are you fucking kidding? And next thing you know, we've gone from these pubs, but we were working our asses off. You know, we were playing every night of the week if people would have us. And we were playing for free. We were playing absolutely anywhere, like outside pubs, like acoustic sets, fully plugged in, anything. The next night, you know, we were playing in a pub, and the next night we were playing in the Hydro Arena with like a full crew and, you know, a full thousands and thousands and thousands of people absolutely cacking ourselves. And then we did those dates. And then the night after, we were back playing to like 30 people. And it really was. But then once we'd done that, you know, that opened so many doors. So we very quickly sort of climbed the ranks and we're suddenly playing sort of bigger places. It's bizarre because, like, it's such a different style of music. Like, obviously, it's sort of rock, but he's like the roots of rock and the sort of, you know, one of the guitar gods and like classic rock. So it's amazing that they had us, but it's very, you know, we don't share the same audience, for example, which is, I find it strange that we were even asked to do it, but God bless Eric Clapton.
It's a great experience to sort of go and play to someone else's crowd. You're kind of playing as some people are taking their seats and kind of trying to grab people's attention.
Clapton's audience are like the most attentive audience in the world. So we had the same chat with everybody involved at the time. They were like, just so you know, guys, it's a support tour, so it's likely that people are still going to be at the bar, you know, at the merch stand and all that kind of stuff. And we walked out on both nights, and there were 14,000 people just sat in their seats ready to be entertained. There was no, like, you know, people getting up and moving. They'd all sort of been ushered to their seats by then, probably because they're all in Zimmer frames. so yeah, there was that. But I think one thing about the Clapton tour is that he was doing a world tour at that time, and he'd just done all of America and come back to the UK for two dates and then was about to go out and do the rest of Europe. So he was really being worked, you know, like his stage setup was just being constantly rotated around the world. And I think he only really had time on his tour to come back and do, like, it was one in Scotland and one in England and then straight off again.
But to play, I mean, his fans must have been so excited that he was in the UK, having been around the world then. So you imagine, like, that would have been so, as you say, so attentive for that reason, because they're really excited. So that must have been a fantastic experience.
For him, it was like an intimate gig, you know, an intimate gig in the arena.
We made to feel very welcome. We, you know, in Glasgow, we were kind of, we'd played Glasgow a bunch of times and we had family there and stuff. And then the next night was Leeds Arena, and we were a bit like, oh shit, I don't know how Leeds are gonna sort of take to us. And we walked out on stage and it was dead silent. And because we didn't have like a walk-on tune or anything, in hindsight, we should have walked out to like Baywatch theme or something. we'd come out and it was just this awkward silence, and this woman from like row Z just goes, "Welcome to Leeds!" And we were like, but then Clarkie had an amazing mishap that night that he should tell you about.
Well, it's just it's like a result of us being skint, really, and like having like gear, well, me specifically having gear that barely worked in terms of like all my pedals and stuff. I didn't have them on a board, I just had them on the deck plugged in with patch leads. So I'd like managed to rent for cheap a really nice SVT stack. But then I went to sort of play the first note, because I remember we like had like this sort of like cymbal swell ring out to sort of set the tone, make sure everyone can hear everything, and then we'd go. But I hit the string and nothing happened. And it's like, I'm looking around and there's like, everything seems to be plugged in. And I remember the stage manager, who was really nice to us, was called Adam. And I just went, I like looked over at him and said, "Adam!" And he was like, and I was like, So then I basically just unplugged the bass from these rubbish pedals and just went straight in the amp and just gunned it all the way without having to think about tuning. But it turned out to be fine in the end. But yeah, that was a crash course in never skimp out on a pedal board playing to 15,000 people. You idiot.
With a very similar thing, me and my, I was in a kind of Irish sort of folk rock band kind of thing, and we got Dropkick Murphys in Boston, House of Blues, on Paddy's Day. And we were like, it was really early on for us as well. We weren't ready for it whatsoever. We were nothing about the bass player at all. And then it was someone from the crew had just switched the standby switch on the amp. So he's going around, he's unplugging his bass, trying to work it. It was just someone just coming to say to him, click, and just turned it on again. And it was like, oh, the first note of our this momentous occasion. Yeah. Was how he had no bass in the first minute of the song or something. Yes.
I was lucky you managed to pull it round again in about 15 seconds, but I was...
This is so bad.
It still gives me palpitations and runny bums.
It's like an insecurity dream, isn't it? Like, just one of the things you do. You look down, you have no trousers on.
I think I had a similar one on my first gig with Hunter and the Bear where... I can't remember the venue, it was in Inverness or something, and I was borrowing Will's guitar. And Will's guitar has a funny thing where you plug the lead in, and it was like, everything's going well, first two tunes, rocking out, it's like first gig, it's like settling in. And then I swap guitar, and like I'm using Will's guitar, I tried to put my jack lead in, and it's just like, I'm like, ah. And just that like, happens about four times, and everyone's looking around. And I think Will said, you said something on stage that, oh, well, that's the last time you played with us or something, like to the whole crowd. And I was like, oh, God.
Can't even plug in his own guitar.
That's Clarkie's Adam moment where he was like, Adam! That's become like our word for like, if something's going wrong, you just shout Adam.
It's like a safe word, safety word, you know?
Yeah, it's like if it's still funny because like even if you're playing in front of a crowd, everything's going great, and suddenly you've cocked up and like your equipment is failing you. You just think of that, and it's like it's not as bad as when Clarkie did it at the Clapton gig. So it's
fine. I wanted to talk to you guys about your latest single, Digital Light, which got to number one in the iTunes Rock chart. So tell us a bit about that.
We were really happy that it got to number one in the rock chart. It's basically the first of a new sort of batch of stuff that we recorded with a guy called Ramesh, who's an absolute boss down in Cardiff. We did that. And he, you know, it's an album. And he, you know, he's like a step up for us in terms of like production and that whole world. So it was really, we feel like we've finally been able to actually record stuff that sounds exactly like we want it to sound. So that was the first offering from that. And we're really blown away by the reaction to it.
I mean, to see that from the last album, I think every song is released as a single. And is that the plan going forward to keep releasing? I mean, I'm doing a similar thing with my band, actually. With our album, we've now gone to release them all as singles in 6-week breaks. Was it a conscious thing to release them all as singles for that reason, the last one, and is it the same? Is it planned for the same?
I think originally with the first album, it was kind of like we could only afford to record like one song at a time, and it was like we'd write a song, record it, and then release it, and then we'd just do that because studio time is really expensive. And if you know, like, luckily when we recorded Digital Light, we all locked ourselves away for a month and we did the whole thing and like really got in the zone. But for Paper Heart, it was very much just like, you know, record one song and then show it to everyone immediately. Whereas Digital Light and the new stuff, it's a bit of a new chapter. We've been able to like properly lock down on it and have a bit more of a game plan in place. So yeah,
I think we still will release like a bunch of them as singles, because I think the way people listen to music these days, songs can get lost for the most part if you just throw an album out. And we really believe in every song that we put on an album. It's like we think it could be a single, which is why we did it the first time. You know, we don't write songs that we don't think stand on their own as a thing for people to get into. So, you know, if we could, we would release them all as a single. But with, you know, in with the way it works, I think it makes more sense to maybe do two or three singles and then drop the whole shebang. But then that's just so many arguments to come about, like, what song will be the next singles. But I mean, we would have, if the virus hadn't been here, we probably would have had like two or three singles out by now. But we want to get them out as soon as we can, because it's just, you know, it's frustrating just sitting on this material.
This is the Need to Know Music show, so we like to ask everyone for a recommendation, and it was Lewis Coop that recommended you guys, so from a previous interview. So I'd like to go around each of you, and do you have a recommendation for us of someone that people should check out they may not necessarily know? So we'll start with you, Will, seeing as we're on you.
I am going to go with one of my favourite sort of acoustic performers who, you know, he's not a sort of just starting out, so people will know him, but a lot of people won't. His name's Gregory Alan Isakoff, and he's like my go-to for just like if I'm ever want to listen to kind of chilled songs, it's always a bit of Gregory. So Gregory.
I second that, actually. I do know his stuff, and he's the same go-to for me, in fairness. So, John.
I hate being put on the spot like this. I'm like, oh, my God. But if I had one person, only because I've listened to him loads in the past week, I'd say Theo Katzman. He's a great singer-songwriter, great all-round musician, great guitar player. His songs are awesome. So, yeah, Theo Katzman. Check him out.
And Chris?
Oh, nice. I love a bit of Theo. Probably say there's a buddy of mine from back home, a guy called Dan Owen, who is a sort of singer-songwriter but has like full band on record. But he's a good dude, and that's how I know Lewis, actually, through him. So.
Right. Brilliant. And Gareth?
Are we talking inspiration or someone that is like up and coming?
Someone that people should check out, yeah.
Oh, right. I was going to say Stevie Wonder. Most people have checked him out. Listeners are loads of Stevie Wonder.
There's this really
Michael Jackson.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Some friends of ours that are a really good band that are sort of up and coming. They're a duo. They're called Rival Karma. And they're lovely, and their stuff is really sort of like it's really coming to a head now. They're releasing stuff all the time, and it's inspiring to see sort of, you know, just other bands like we've been explaining, you know, coming up through the ranks, and those guys have really put in the hard work, and their music is great, and they're, you know, they're definitely worth checking out. So yeah, I'd say them.
Yeah, I think bands really do benefit from getting out there, and just we can tell the ones that have really cut their teeth and really put the work in. It sounds like you guys are really hitting a really good vein of form and knowing each other and just synergy. Sounds like it's really come together for you guys in this next record. So we look forward to hearing all the fruits of your labor over the coming weeks and months. So thanks for joining us, guys. Thank you so much. And good luck with everything.
Thank you.
And we'll hopefully catch up with you again when we're in a studio and doing it properly. It'd be nice for you to come in and do it all in the same room. Would be amazing.
That would be
old
great.
School.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thanks very much for joining us. Good luck.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for having us.
See you later.
Cheers.